Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books podcast with me, Richard Lee. They're with us at the entrance to our lives and usher us towards the exit. They take care of us when we struggle to take care of ourselves. But who takes care of the doctors? According to the psychologist Caroline Elton, all too few. She'll be joining us later to discuss her study of medicine's emotional toll, also human. But she got us all thinking about the wave of literary medics marching onto our bookshelves. Claire Armistead and Sian Kane are here in the studio to examine the symptoms. So, Claire, what's your diagnosis?
Well, I think actually a lot of doctors are very clever, cultured people. That's one answer. Another answer is that there's a very big fashion for memoir, but it's memoir hooked to something else, whether it's science, nature. We've had a big boom in nature. But my goodness, medicine and memoir, you've got a double whammy there, haven't you?
Right there.
Because everybody's interested in the sort of inside the human body and all those horror stories and things. I mean, there's a sort of voyeuristic interest. Mm.
And certainly people's lives as well. Perfect.
There's also that thing about how doctors, when you go to see a doctor, they're interested in your history and your story. So it's kind of almost that thing of putting a case into that kind of narrative context is kind of part of their toolkit.
Yeah. And I mean, you've got brilliant doctor writers like Gavin Francis, who we did on the podcast, actually, when his Adventures in Human Being came out. And he's got another one called Shapeshifters, which is out in a couple of weeks. And he absolutely does that. He puts everything in the context of magic, of myth, of art, of literature. And you've just sort of got everything. And the way he looks at, he talks about the body almost like a metaphor, which in a way it is.
And there's also the sense that, I mean, doctors used to be these kind of remote figures handing down their judgments on tablets of stone. But now we're kind of getting to the point whereby a doctor might almost be a human being as well. So maybe that's, again, something that these writers are exploring.
That's something that comes up in Your Life in My Hands, which is a polemical book, sort of less memoir, more political, by Rachel Clark, who is a doctor in the NHS. And she wrote this book, and it's basically just to convey what a state the NHS is in the UK and just what sort of circumstances and environments doctors are working in. And it does convey to you that you do think doctors are these sort of superhuman people that can function on 4 hours sleep and do back-to-back shifts, but she's sort of saying, well, yes, we can cope, but it's certainly not the ideal situation. I mean, there's one ward that she talks about, there's one sort of very throwaway line, but it always stays with me, that there was a ward she worked on where the other doctors referred to it as Beirut was the name they gave it, just because the state of it was so bad. And it was in, you know, recent London, you know, it's supposed to be state-of-the-art hospital, and it was in absolutely appalling state.
It is a very politically contested area, particularly in the UK at the moment, isn't it? I mean, there's an awful lot of bad news pouring out of the National Health Service. Yeah. So there is activist doctor literature.
And perhaps that's why we're ready to hear about the kind of human cost of being a medic as well. I mean, I'm thinking back to Henry Marsh, Do No Harm, which is he was a neurosurgeon who wrote about particular case studies about the kind of the amazing things that he was doing with people's brains and kind of how the knife going half a millimetre that way or that way has these massive consequences. But behind that was the story as well of what it took to be that person, how you could be that disconnected from life and the kind of emotional cost of having this responsibility with people.
I did an event at the Cambridge Literary Festival last week with Robert McCrum, who was part of his book. His is a memoir of having survived a stroke. And he goes to see Henry Marsh, and they talk about the mistakes that doctors make. And one of the mistakes that they meditate on is the mistake of saving somebody's life for them to then go on and have a worse future. So somebody who was brought back from the brink of death and then developed dementia and things say, would it have been better if I had allowed this person to die? So, I mean, they are the nearest to, I mean, we don't worship priests anymore. We don't, you know, teachers, oh God knows, nobody worships poor old teachers anymore. The doctor is the nearest person to a sort of magic man, isn't he, or magic woman.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's a heavy responsibility that we all want to, it's life and death questions, isn't it? That we all want to hear about the kind of nitty gritty of that.
Yeah, life and death, but also there's a lot about how we can beat death. I mean, that's, you know, the extension of life in both directions. So saving more premature babies and keeping people alive longer once they are actually there. And Gavin Francis's Shapeshifter is all about change. And his theme is how change is what makes us human through all these phases of life. And you say, well, that it's sort of almost bordering on philosophy, but the philosophy of the body. Fascinating.
There's another recent book, and people would have heard her recently on the podcast, is Jules Montague's Lost and Found, which is very much a philosophical book. It's not really a medical book. And it does look at, it basically looks at conditions that affect our sense of self. So things that impact our memory, so things like dementia, Alzheimer's, and also other conditions like, for example, Parkinson's, where the treatment is often dopamine, which then often results in a sort of huge surge in creativity in people that take it, which then changes their personality, because sometimes, you know, they go on and start becoming obsessed with art and go off and become a sculptor and stuff like that. But the book itself is very much a sort of, each chapter is a different condition, and it sort of ends with a sort of musing on whether, are you still the same person if you've got this condition before and after it? And it's much more philosophical than medical.
You can hear Gavin Francis and Henry Marsh, of course, in the archives on this podcast. But I mean, speaking of medical masters, next week we're going to be finding out the winner of the Wellcome Book Prize, one of those awards where I always think the shortlist is so often the very best kind of reading list. So what are the highlights on the list for you, Sian?
Well, one of the highlights, one of the best books I read last year was The Butchering Art by Lindsay Fitzharris, which is a history of Victorian medicine, but it's told through the story of Joseph Lister, who basically is the father of what we call antisepsis. There's antisepsis, which is basically removing bacteria, and then there's asepsis, which is making sure there's no bacteria at all, which is basically how medicine functions today. But he was the father of antisepsis, and so it's a wonderful book. It's really vivid, really colourful. There's all these amazing characters. There's this surgeon called Robert Liston, who used to pull out a stopwatch. He used to have these surgery, you know, these rooms where you'd be doing surgery and you'd have a crowd that would come in for entertainment to watch you do surgery. And he'd pull out a stopwatch and he'd go, "Time me, gentlemen." And then he'd start hacking off someone's leg using his, he was a really big man. He used his own hands as a tourniquet and hack off someone's leg.
Wow.
So it's like full of amazing stories like that. And if you have a very strong stomach, it's one of the most entertaining books that I've read in recent history.
But it's kind of history and biography all wrapped
up
together.
Yeah, exactly. And actually her next book is going to be sort of something similar. It's a history of modern plastic surgery, but told through the story of Dr. Harold Gillies, who basically mastered his craft with soldiers coming back from the First World War.
Yeah, so blood and gore again.
Yeah, hooray.
Well, how about you, Claire? What's your highlights on the,
well,
on the welcome list?
I think I always think this is a fascinating list. And last year, my list, the Kerengal, won it to with Mend the Living, the story of the journey of a heart during a day. The beginning of the day, a boy dies, and by the end of the day, a woman has a new heart. It's totally brilliant. And so I'm always interested in the fiction they choose. And this year, it's Stay With Me, which is Ayobami Adebayo, who's Nigerian, who actually we've also had on this podcast. You hear things here some first sometimes, don't you? And it's about living with sickle cell trait and losing babies to sickle cell. I think that's really interesting because it's not an area that, you know, it is massively prevalent in the world, but it's not a subject I've seen dealt with before. And living with something which is both chronic and can be acute and fatal is it's a really big subject. But there are a couple of, so I wouldn't be surprised if that didn't get through, to be honest. But there are a couple that I'm more surprised about, like the Sigrid Rousing.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Well, I read it. Basically, I did a news story, and because I'm Australian, this was a very big news story, I think, in the US and the UK. And I had never actually heard this story. And then there was a news story about the release of this book. Basically, Sigrid Rousing is a part of a very sort of famous, wealthy family.
The Tetra Pak heiress, yeah. She's known as.
And her brother is a man called Hans Christian Rousing. He had a problem with drugs. He married a woman called Eva, who was an American sort of philanthropist, socialite. She also had a problem with drugs. They met in rehab in the early 90s. And then in 2012, Hans Christian was arrested in London, and his wife's body was found under some building materials on a bed in their house. Their house was absolutely just ruined.
It was quite squalid. Advanced state of decomposition.
Yeah, it was
wasn't
like
it?
A beautiful London mansion, and then it was absolutely squalid on the inside. And Sigrid Rousing, Hans Christian's sister, has written this book about drug addiction.
But it's funny because it's about the social costs of drug addiction,
yes,
isn't it? It's not really about the medical side of
drug
addiction.
No, it's not about the medical side at all, but I think it's a very affecting account of the social cost of drug addiction, particularly because this family family is so wealthy, and you know, access to resource isn't really an issue for them, and yet it ended in such tragedy. I think she's the editor of Granta. She sort of knows her way around writing, and it's very well written, but it's certainly not a medical. I don't think it's a medical book.
Also on the list is With the End in Mind by Catherine Mannix, To Be a Machine by Mark O'Connell, and The Vaccine Race by Meredith Wadman. Caroline Elton is a psychologist who specialises in helping doctors. Also Human brings together extraordinary stories of doctors pushed to the limit, struggling with the pressures of the life and death nature of their profession. She joined Claire Armistead in the studio, but first we hear from one of her case studies, Tessa, read by Susie Grimshaw.
Tessa told me her mother had died at the age of 41 when Tessa was 11. She came from a family of four children and she was the eldest. When we talked about her early family life, Tessa remembered that she'd actually wanted to train as a doctor before her mother had become ill. Her grandfather had been a GP, and as a little girl, she had often stayed with her grandparents during the holidays and seen his patients walking up the garden path to the surgery next door to the house. But after her mother's death, her goal had switched from wanting to follow in her grandfather's footsteps and be a GP to treating patients suffering from cancer. "I put all of myself into my work," Tessa said. Whilst she won prizes and plaudits, this intense emotional investment in her work took its toll. In her late 20s, she was diagnosed with Crohn's disease, an autoimmune disorder of the gut. It's a horrible condition to manage, as the symptoms include violent diarrhea, difficulty absorbing food, severe pain, and extreme fatigue. Although genetic predisposition and childhood infections are recognised as causing the condition, emotional stress influences the course that the disease takes. For over 20 years, Tessa had suffered from a particularly severe form of the disease characterised by frequent hospital stays and different surgical interventions, interspersed with ever-decreasing periods of remission when she felt well. Tessa had tried reducing her hours and going part-time, but in the end realised that she had become too unwell to continue. "I had to give up work in order to live," was how she put it. Tessa recognised that the intensity of her commitment to her patients made her ill. But why would a doctor continue working for over a quarter of a century when it extracted such a high personal cost? It's difficult to make sense of this without recourse to the psychoanalytical idea that people are driven, often without being aware, to seek ways in the present to deal with unresolved emotions from the past, especially from infancy and childhood. John Ballot and Penelope Campling describe this clearly. They write, "The unconscious motivation is often to heal a sick or dead family member, and the guilt and fear of facing failure can become channeled into a relentless drive to work even harder. Unfortunately, the choice of work brings not only the opportunity for reparation and healing, but also repeats the experience of failing the incurable, which in turn further feeds the associated emotional drive to apply oneself to this impossible task." And this is exactly what happened to Tessa. She worked at this impossible task until her own health failed. It's alongside the intensity of Tessa's commitment to patients with cancer and her sorrow at having to take early retirement, there was an enormous passion for life. When we discussed how she now wanted to make use of her medical knowledge and skills, she realised that she wanted to shift from illness to well-being. As an oncologist, she had been interested in mindfulness meditation as a way of helping patients manage distressing and painful symptoms. Now she wanted to train as a mindfulness teacher and offer sessions to healthcare staff, as opposed to working directly with patients. And perhaps most important of all, in the absence of patients, for the first time in her life, she had prioritised her own health over the health of others.
Caroline, you must have one of the most fascinating jobs for anybody who is interested at all in psychology or psychotherapy, to actually have the inside track on what is happening in the lives of doctors.
Yes, it is a very interesting job. It's an enormous privilege, I would say, to hear the stories and try to support the very many doctors who come my way, from medical student through to... Yesterday I saw somebody, it was a very unusual for me and a real pleasure, somebody who's recently retired from a very distinguished career and wants to think about what they're going to do post-retirement. And it's the only time it's happened, so it's not somebody who's suffering or unwell or desperately unhappy, quite the opposite.
So you're basically, one of your roles is careers advice.
I'm an occupational psychologist and a counselling psychologist. So my core business, I would say, is complex career counselling. So I help people who are experiencing difficulties at work. And very often, a lot of the doctors I see, their career decision making is complicated by health issues. Typically mental health issues are the ones I see, but sometimes physical health issues as well, and sometimes both.
You make the point early on in the book that in 2006, the system of training was changed. So junior doctors have to specialise much earlier, which puts huge pressure on them.
It does. You may remember Remedy UK and medical mums marching to Whitehall, and that was because of the MTAS, the medical training application system, which crashed. It had never been piloted before, and there was actually a government inquiry, but that was just one tiny technical bit of these huge changes, which were called MMC, Modernising Medical Career, and they were the largest overhaul of medical training, certainly, that happened in the 20th century. So junior doctors do have to decide at an earlier stage, although interestingly, doctors are clever people and they are now pushing the system to decide a bit later. So the system is trying to corral them into leaving medical school, doing 2 years of foundation and then getting on track after that. But actually, so there's F1 foundation year one, F2 foundation year two, but more and more are now taking an unofficial F3 because they're not ready to decide and they know they're not ready.
So this book, Also Human, comes with very strong recommendations from Batal Gawande, who also has written about medicine, obviously, but also from Hilary Mantel, who talks about the wounded healer.
Yeah.
And that is sort of the nub of it, isn't it, of what you're dealing with?
Yes, I am. I would say it is the nub, but the wound can have very many sources. So the second chapter looks at the traumatic things that doctors have to deal with just as part of their work. And sometimes this can be particularly traumatic for people who have themselves in their own lives experienced trauma. But then sometimes it would be traumatic for anybody. So the trauma can be individual trauma, it can be external. And also one of the things that I want the reader to understand is just the sheer length of training and how disruptive it is of lives and the wounds that can cause. The fact that training can, for some specialties, it can be 10 years full-time after leaving medical school. That would be 20 years, you know, mind-bogglingly. So, yeah, there's a lot of wounds, but they come from a lot of different sources.
But you also, and I think it's in that same chapter, talk about the fact that doctors will choose sometimes, subconsciously, choose specialisms that chime with traumas they've suffered in their youth.
Absolutely, because we all have a desire to accommodate and respond to the psychological issues in our own lives. We see that in relationships, and we don't doubt that. We see people who've had certain relationships with parents making certain sorts of choices when it comes to partners, but that actually happens in work. And in an earlier, one of the bits that went, and I think rightly went from an earlier cut because it was rather long-winded, but we talk about, for example, a client I had in the days when I saw non-medical clients who had drifted in. He had originally been trained to do university careers guidance, but he had drifted into doing university debt management with students. He worked as a debt counsellor. And a lot later on, I found out that his father was a moneylender. And he had a very difficult relationship with his father. Now, that choice, he hadn't been trained to do debt advice. He'd been trained to do careers advice. He's working in a university support service, but he drifts the debt advice.
But you have that examples of doctors who do
yes,
that.
Yes,
for example, a doctor who
exactly.
specialised in oncology, whose father, sibling
absolutely.
Father had died of leukaemia.
No, so the point I'm saying is that this doesn't only apply to doctors. It can apply to everybody. But it, given that doctors are dealing with health, and are therefore, as part of their day-to-day work, exposed to people who have different diseases, you can see it in a very, very clear way. And so we see it, people whose parents have died of cancer, who want to go and become oncologists, or they become palliative care physicians. We see it in all sorts of different ways. And it doesn't need to be parents. It could be siblings or any other
But person. It's the basic material of the yeah. book is case histories that
yeah.
you quote from your own experience. And some of them are quite shocking. There's one of a consultant who delegates down to the most junior member of the team the sorting out of a dead baby.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then doesn't support
yeah.
this person.
Yeah.
And I just was thinking, how could that person be a consultant, and how could they be so totally deaf to the cries for help from that junior member of staff?
Well, absolutely. And I hear these sorts of examples all the time from consultants. So, for example, recently I had a client who was attacked following the Westminster terrorist attack. She is an young Asian woman, and she was attacked in the street queuing up to go to a club, and she sustained very serious injury to her leg, and she's working in A&E, and her consultant has been so she can't stand for long periods of time, and her consultant has been brutal, absolutely brutal. This is a few weeks ago I saw this woman. So I think that the consultants can be like that, or more senior registrars can be like that, because they may be exhausted, they may have been on call. It may, in other examples I give, like with the obstetrician who can't get pregnant, and her own consultants are so unsympathetic. Turns out that the consultant who was particularly unsympathetic herself had fertility issues. So it can remind them of their own vulnerabilities. Or doctors can become burnt out and so detached that what to the non-medical reader would be a deeply traumatic event, having to go and certify the death of a baby who's been brought in by the ambulance service from a cot death. It can just be as if you're counting rivets. You know, it's just another task to do on the to-do list.
You quote Michael Crichton, who's
yeah.
who obviously went on
yeah.
to write Jurassic Park, of talking about, he was a doctor, and talking about the shutting off click.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is so chilling, the shutting off click,
yeah.
the idea that you actually, your humanity is on one side and your professionalism, or your empathy is on one side of the shutting off click, and what you have to do, your functionality is on the other side.
But he goes on to say the best doctors can modulate it so that where necessary, and perhaps I think we can all know this as parents, we might have to do something painful to a child. We might, you know, every day you might need to take medicine or pull off a dressing or something which is aversive to the child, but we have to do it because it's their own good, and we do it and comfort them afterwards. But some people in the medical training literature, some people have been arguing about this notion of detached concern, which is sort of what Michael Crichton was talking about. But Crichton does go on to say that actually you need to be able to adopt I see it almost like a dimmer switch, or that you can modulate it. And I think it's more helpful to see it as the task for doctors is to have some flexibility on that switch, whereas often I think the model is on and off.
One of the issues that plays quite a central
yeah.
role is the fact that more than a quarter of doctors working in the UK in 2016
yeah.
were trained, had their primary training outside
yeah.
the UK.
Yeah.
Therefore, they're coming in with very different outlooks. And how is that managed?
Well, again, it can be managed well, but there can be a kind of complete lack of understanding of what it might be like for some of these doctors. So they will, if they're out of the EU, they will have had to take exams. They're not just coming from anywhere around the world and just being, you know, helicoptered into the Leicester Royal Infirmary or wherever. There are a series of it, both English exams, spoken English exams and written English exams and medical exams they have to take. But often they're so lonely and often induction is so poor. And they may have to apply for God knows how many jobs and then go to a part of the country where they know nobody and have absolutely no support. And in the chapter Risky Business, I also wanted to show the really distressing levels of racism that permeate the system. And so they're unsupported. They may not have had very good induction. And then they encounter what they encounter.
And this business of being sent to somewhere far away from where you want to go, where you don't know anyone, is obviously widespread because that doesn't just affect doctors from overseas, does it?
So they're two separate issues, really. If you come from overseas, depending upon your visa, you probably won't be able to apply for what's called a training post. And a training post is when you're on a career ladder that will take you, well, depending, basically will allow you to become a consultant, a simplified statement, not 100% accurate, but that's the main statement. And international doctors outside the EU may not be eligible to apply for those posts. So they are just looking for vacancies. They're going into the, looking at the BMJ, they're looking at NHS jobs, and they are often going to the parts of the country that other doctors don't want to work in. And often there are reasons why other doctors don't want to work there.
And also, but it also affects...
But it also affects trainees.
So the people who are least successful get sent to the most difficult postings.
Yes, that is... So there was a GP, very famous GP, Julian Tudor Hart, who wrote about the inverse care law in terms of patient care and how all the way the structures work for the most vulnerable patients to get the worst quality of medical care. And I think there's an educational variant of it. So that certainly in terms of foundation placements, which is critical because that's your first job after leaving medical school, there are all sorts of ways in which those doctors who've performed less well will mop up the positions that nobody else wants. And also, if they get put on the waiting list, the reserve list, because in the first allocation they don't get a job, they may not know within weeks of starting where they're going to be. And they could be in Northern Ireland. I mean, they could be anywhere in the United Kingdom. With nobody there to support them. And then little wonder that some of them, and I write about some case studies, some of them start and they absolutely go into meltdown. It can be within days. So the doctor I wrote about, Rama, went into meltdown within days. And others...
And where was Rama?
Rama was actually... I don't want to say exactly where she was, but she was not that far from... She came from London. She trained in a London medical school. She was out of London, but she wasn't in Scotland. But it was the first time she was living away from home as well.
And obviously... Part of the concern about these terrible things that happen to doctors is that it impacts on their patients.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there's no doubt about that. I mean, there is a very comprehensive literature to show all the different ways in which if the doctor is depressed, they make more mistakes. If you're very tired, you make more mistakes. If you are very dissatisfied with your own work, your patients are less satisfied with the treatment that they receive. The patients are less likely to stick to the medical regimen that they've been advised. So there are all sorts of ways in which, understandably, because essentially the doctor and patient, it's a relationship that you have with this clinician. And if the clinician is not thriving, it is going to impact on the patient.
Who do you think will read this book? Who is it aimed at?
Well, I might say rather boldly that I would hope that the people who read Being Mortal, that's my
Gawande's
fantasy.
Book.
Gawande's Being Mortal or Gavin France's Adventures in Human Being, the people who are reading those books. I mean, obviously they're books like Adam Kay's recent book, This Is Gonna Hurt, which I enjoyed, and I was interested how at the end he came to a very similar conclusion through a different route to mine. But I would see those sorts of gallows humour accounts of the life of a junior doctor as slightly different than Being Mortal or Adventures in Human Being, in the sense that Being Mortal also is personal, Atul Gawande's experience as a doctor, but also looking at the literature as well. And that's what I've attempted to do. I don't know if I've succeeded.
So it's packed with case histories.
Yeah.
And you talk a couple of times, you mention emailing somebody to ask if they'd mind being included.
Yeah,
you presumably change the names and the specific details.
Yes. So everybody, all the doctors who've come to see me for support have agreed. And not only have they agreed in some abstract way, I sent them the chapter in which they... I didn't just send them what I'd written about them, I sent them the chapter, because I wanted them to understand the overall point, why I had included their story in the context of the chapter. And I have been bowled over by their generosity. I had only one who didn't get back to me, and he's somebody I'd seen quite recently. He had a very significant physical disability, and there was no way I could write about this doctor without
mentioning his disability.
I wanted to talk. He was the doctor who got me interested in the whole issue of what happens when doctors become disabled. But he, so I left him out of the chapter. And actually, because he had the most significant disability, he was the one who alerted me to the issue. But then in the deaf doctor I'd seen previously, and the doctor losing their sight. So I just chose different case studies. But in the main, doctors have been incredibly generous with allowing me to tell their story. But because I've sent them everything, they've also asked me, and I changed it when I sent them, but sometimes there were things that they asked me to take out, and I just took them out.
In your conclusion, you talk about a systematic cyclectomy.
Yeah.
That is very, very strong, isn't
it? That's my word. My word.
It has been excised. It has been surgically removed.
The psychological
needs of doctors have been surgically and systematically removed from the system.
Yeah. I think so. I think that's the conclusion I reached, because the chapters are all about... The themes of the chapters arose because these were themes that were just... I was hearing in my office again and again and again. Obviously, the particularities were different, but women talking about the sheer impossibility of completing their training with a young family. BME doctors just recounting, as I talk about this experience, or some of the experiences that BME doctors have had.
Black and minority ethnic.
Black and minority ethnic doctors. Doctors talking about what happens when they become ill, particularly if it's a psychiatric illness. Doctors talking about trauma, some of the really, really hideous things they've had to do, and just no support for it. So the chapters, the themes of the chapters came from the recurrent themes that I've heard about over the last 10 years. But what unites them was this theme that medical training has lost sight of the fact that doctors have psychological needs, and that their work has psychological effects in all sorts of different ways. And therefore, if you don't attend to them, then this ultimately is going to trickle down and affect all of us when we are patients.
You do have some example of international good practice.
Yeah.
And some UK. Yeah. So, for example, New Zealand.
Yeah. I mean, I find this deeply shocking, in the sense that I can't remember when I think it was in the late 90s, there's a paper in the British Medical Journal saying, from some New Zealand doctors saying, perhaps the UK might like to think of this. Well, it's buried. Basically, they make this transition from medical student to junior doctor much more gradual. and they have an intern year where the doctor is paid. They are paid 60% of the junior doctor salary. So it's a very gradual way. It's not this all or nothing. You have no responsibility. You have complete responsibility.
And no pay. And
no pay and paid. And also, you will be doing that year where you've been training as well. So you will be still attached to your medical school with all your systems of all your mates and any pastoral support. So you're in situ where you've been in medical school and being a medical student in the hospital, and you are this intern, you are paid, you do real work, but there is really close supervision.
And the reason why it's not adopted here is presumably because we're in an age of austerity, and that would be 60, expensive.
It would be incredibly expensive because it's 60% instead of medical students paying fees, it's 60% of the
for the sixth year of their training.
And it hasn't been extensively studied, but there is a few studies, and they do suggest that this really the catastrophic effects on mental health, which have been written about in the UK for the last 30 years. There was a psychologist, Jenny Firth Cousins, who's done some excellent work, who started writing about this 30 years ago. When two junior doctors, she was a clinical and occupational psychologist, actually, and two junior doctors went to see her and said, Jenny, two junior doctors in our trust have committed suicide and nobody has said anything.
And we have had several examples recently, as you mentioned at the start of the book, of doctors, young doctors committing suicide. Yeah.
And I read a blog, it was actually in the Canadian Medical Journal, but it was written by an Irish professor of general practice. And I tracked him down. He's called Donald McCauley. And I had an amazing phone conversation. We had an email correspondence. And then we spoke on the phone. And I realised, when I was speaking on the phone, I said, I feel so angry. Rose Polger, who was one of the junior doctors who committed suicide tragically, who got a lot of coverage because it was the time of the junior doctor strike, and had the most, I never met her, but she had the most really endearing smile. And I said to Donald McCauley, I feel so angry. And he said, hang on to your anger, hang on to it and use it. And that was really liberating, actually, when writing those chapters, because obviously I've also had quite an academic background. And there's a, I think the challenge also when writing books like this is not to sort of fall back on a very academic, rather dry, rather dispassionate voice.
But to use that anger.
And it is so shocking. It continues to shock me. And I feel passionately about it because for me this isn't an academic issue. Yes, I've read the academic literature, but I have these doctors sitting as close to me as you, well, probably, you know, as you are sitting here in this studio, in floods of tears, always apologizing if they break down.
Caroline Elton was speaking with Claire Armistead, and Also Human is published by Heinemann. Next week, we're losing the thread as I head off into the dizzying world of mazes in search of Henry Elliot. That is, as long as I can find him. Meanwhile, you can subscribe and review us on all your favourite podcatchers, and let us know of your favourite medical writers on Twitter or by leaving a comment on the podcast page. Or you can always email us direct at bookspodcast@theguardian.com. But for now, from me, Richard Lee, and our producer, Susanna Tresillian, goodbye and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.